Our thanks to Rollbar for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Rollbar makes it easy to detect, diagnose, and fix production errors. Instead of relying on user-reported errors or manually digging through logs, Rollbar helps you catch and fix errors early with no headaches. When something goes wrong, Rollbar will notify you however you choose. That means you can easily get alerted in Slack, HipChat, or email, and even turn errors into issues in Jira, Pivotal Tracker, Trello, and others. Rollbar's error tracking includes all the info you need to fix bugs fast. Stack traces, request parameters, which users have been affected, and more. It can even hook into your source control to help link bugs to specific pieces of code. Lots of great companies trust Rollbar to help them manage errors, including Heroku, Instacart, Zendesk, and Twitch. As a special offer for Does Not Compute listeners, Rollbar is offering 1 month of their Bootstrap plan for free. Just head to rollbar.com/DNC and sign up. You and your users both deserve good error handling, so give Rollbar a try today. So I redid my site yesterday, Sean, for the first time in a little while.
Oh, let me look right now.
It's the top part's the same, but I added, basically I brought my blog back into it finally for the first time in a really long time. My blog is actually on paulstrau.com.
You're not blog?
No, well, this is just a real bloggy thing. I used Netlify CMS.
Oh, yes.
That's what I was messaging you about that yesterday. That's what I was working on. I just decided I was going to go for it. And so I went and I set up they have a tutorial on the Netlify CMS site, where you deploy like a coffee site, basically. And I just did that. And then I customized it from there. Took, I don't know, probably like an hour and a half to get the full site up and running, and now I have this great CMS, so I can edit things from any web browser, right? And
wow, that's cool.
It actually makes commits back to GitHub, so it's all stored in source control and just available everywhere. Really, really awesome stuff, and it's all running on Netlify, so I get their CDN and all that. Very, very happy with it so far, though.
That reminds me a lot of Statamake, when we were working with Statamake a lot. How you could, kind of like a post stave hook, it would commit the changes back to the repo, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, it's a exact same concept. It's just that Netlify CMS is built around that as the core thing, and it's actually got a ton of power that I haven't gotten super deep into yet. You can actually have different types of pages set up with custom components. So you can have like a Jumbotron component, and then that's actually editable in the CMS. It's got a lot of hooks. Really cool. Really, really cool.
So you kind of make your own like content block style.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they provide a bunch of built-in ones like date time and images and all that kind of stuff and generic file uploads. But then you can also just write your own, and it's just React components. So makes it really simple.
So the real question is, what JavaScript library are they using for their daytime select? That's the real question here.
It is React Datetime or something like that, I believe it's called. It's like the most popular one. It's actually pretty good. I like it.
That's just like consistently a thing I've noticed. Obviously, I don't use React quite a bit, but every time I Google daytime select, I don't see any new entries into the market. It's just the same ones.
I mean, I've made my own daytime picker, Sundial, which I don't super actively maintain anymore, but it's not fun. It sounds like it's going to be a fun problem, but it's actually kind of, there's a lot of weird edge cases and it's a lot of work. So I get it. But it would be nice if somebody came out with one that was kind of universal and worked with any JavaScript library and didn't have a ton of dependencies. A lot of them are still dependent on jQuery even.
Yeah, a lot of them are. A lot of them just have, like the ones that look nice just have a ton of dependencies, which is why I never end up using them because I don't need all those dependencies. And most of the date time libraries I've seen come with a ton of dependencies, which is why I don't use them. I actually just keep using the one that you made that one time called something.
Sundial.
Sundial, that's it. I use that because it works. it works for what I need. But yeah, it's one of those things. Anyhow, I didn't know that Nevfly's CMS did all that stuff. When I looked at it briefly, it seemed to me, and I think when you first asked me about it, it looked to me like the admin panel that exists for Jekyll. I don't know if you've ever taken a look at that.
I have not seen that, no.
Yeah, but like that one's really bare bones. It's like about as bare bones. Like you can barely call it a CMS, I suppose, because it has text inputs for content. But
sure. No, this is a full on. This is definitely a full CMS. You could build out a pretty complex site.
That sounds really cool.
Fairly easily.
So, in doing client work, do you think that that would work for? I guess it would depend on the client's needs, right? But
yeah, it really depends. But I mean, certainly a lot of marketing sites, the demo site that they start you off with is actually like a, it's like for a coffee house. So it's all written out and they have like their, you know, contact page and forms set up and all the kind of stuff that you would have on most simple corporate sites. So I think it's definitely feasible.
No, that sounds really cool. I'm going to check it out. I was actually, before we did a call or before you called me, before I actually called you, in fact, I was looking at WordPress.com again. I've been wanting, you kind of get stuck in that loop, right? Like you have a blog and then you don't blog and you get rid of it. And then you're like, man, I should probably write about it. Like I have a couple of ideas, things I could write about. So you do that, you write two articles and then you take your blog away again. So I'm on the downward slope where I'm like, oh, maybe I should do this. It's good for,
yeah.
You know, the more content you have out, presumably the more interesting somebody might find you if you were to need to look for employment, I guess. But also it's just nice to have an outlet sometimes, you know? And what's really cool is that I'm doing a lot of things that I've never had to do before, especially in the back end work. Like today, this morning actually was the first time, and I don't remember how long, that I was writing just raw SQL. I was just poking around a database of species names and scientific data that I downloaded. And I use an app called Postico to just kind of poke around my Postgres databases. But I was, instead of like using a filter UI and stuff like that, I was just writing my own SQL.
Right. And I mean, because you're not really used to that because of all the ORMs that we use as programmers day to day.
Right. So yeah, exactly. So when I use Active Record, I was completely like super removed from SQL syntax. I'm using Ecto a lot, and Ecto is a lot closer to SQL syntax, so it gets me like 3/4 of the way there, I think.
Right, but it's still not actually SQL.
Yes. Right. So I'm like, do I use equals? Do I use in? Do I use double equals? What do I use?
That single equals thing always throws me for a loop.
I was very
man.
Confused, yeah. So I was doing that this morning.
Every time.
Basically, what I would do is I would write out my query in Ecto and then change a few things, and then it was SQL.
dot to SQL.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's probably not how it would work in Ecto.
Right, yeah. If you were using Active Record, you could. That'd be pretty interesting. But yeah, I was doing that. It felt kind of cool. Like a lot of this watch feature stuff that I'm doing, kind of, I have to think a lot more about table structures and things. And I'm not used to that. And a big pain is figuring out how do we, you know, like how should we seed our species common name and scientific name tables? Do we use an API for that? Do we use, you know, there's like CSV downloads, which are like a gigabyte and a half CSV file. Do you like, you know, try to figure out how we want to do that. And it turns out there's a website called itis.gov and they provide SQL downloads. So you download whichever, like if you're using Postgres like I am, I downloaded that and it was just a SQL file. And so I pulled it into a DB and was exploring around with it.
Man, this is amazing. It's so nice to live in a society that prioritizes things like this. Obviously the website's not super modern or anything, but like this is an incredible resource that is presumably paid for by, you know, tax dollars.
Sure.
And that's pretty cool. Like people always talk about government waste, but stuff like this is amazing.
Yeah. There's so much information on it. So we did some filtering and we got it down to like 150,000 because that's a lot, you know, like the most common things we could think of, the most common families that we would, cause like, I'm assuming that people are gonna be taking pictures of like fungus and identifying it at least for a while. Right. I'm sure that niche marketing exists, but I don't have to cater to that yet. And so what we did is we scoped it down.
Right. You can launch with a focus on like North American animals.
Precisely. Basically. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so we scoped it down to like 158,000 records, like just under 158,000, which is, to me, it's like, that's a lot of data. I think that's actually maybe more data than Knight had when we were pulling stuff over. So this might be like the biggest data dump that I've been working with. But yeah, it's pretty amazing. You can just download it, you know? There, like I was doing a lot of Googling. I was like, okay, well, I mean, I could write a scraper to do this. But then I realized quickly that that would take 100,000 years. And it would be just difficult because there's so many, like, depending on the site you're on, it, that means that you're going to get a different data set. And then depending on the site that you're on also means that the content that you're looking for could be more or less organized. And mostly it's less organized, in my opinion. So that was just going to be a whole thing. So Brady and I were doing a Skype call. We're like, all right, well, you know, let's look at our options here. And then we found ITIS, and I found the Postgres SQL file and downloaded that, slapped it into a database. And I'm thinking what I'm going to do is, especially like we're not launched or anything, so I can kind of do whatever I want in terms of getting the original seed data ready. But what I'm thinking is I'm going to write a small module in Elixir that connects to that database and then grabs the data that I need from the various tables and then inserts it into my various species tables. And when we're ready to put up the alpha on staging, which is happening soonish, I'm just going to export the DB and then re-import it.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. That seems...
into the staging environment.
Like a pretty good approach, and it should be fast too.
Yeah. So we were talking about it.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, it should be fine. We were talking about it. And that was one thing that we talked about. I was like, okay, well, pretty much any time I've had to do anything with searching in the past, I've just Elasticsearch it, you know, out of the gate. And Elasticsearch is great and it's fast and it's obviously made for searching and faceted searching. But the stuff that I'm doing out of the gate, I don't need faceted searching. I don't need anything beyond like a simple string comparison, you know? So I was like, okay, well, how slow is this going to be? And so I wrote some SQL to do lookups. And so I'm joining two tables together. I'm joining because the sample database has the common name, which is like the English name, like Peregrine Falcon. And then there's the log name, which I'm calling the scientific name, which is the genus and species, like Latin names. And so I'm joining those two into the results, and then I'm just doing in case sensitive searches using ILIKE, and pretty much everything that I searched for came back in under 150 milliseconds, which isn't like amazingly fast, but I mean,
right,
if for a search request, that's not bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It'll work, and the cool thing is that speed isn't going to be a detriment. You know what I mean? It's not like someone's waiting for like a full second. That'd be a much different story. But this is like...
Well, it'll get you up and running, if nothing else.
Right.
it's so tempting to just jump to, okay, I gotta do Elasticsearch because I need, you know, to handle...
Right.
Some theoretical web scale or whatever, right? But realistically, there's probably lower hanging fruit. And if you're able to implement something that works for right now... and move on to the lower hanging fruit, then you're going to have bigger wins. I guess this is just basically saying avoid premature optimization. But in this particular case, I think that's a really, really tempting one to be like, okay, I have to, of course, start by using Elasticsearch, but you might not.
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think I need to in this case, because really you're just going to be searching for a name like Wolf, and then I will be returning common names to you. And that's it. So, even typing in like Wolf, the most responses or the most results I got were like 400. Like that was the very most. And so that's small enough where I could just return all 400, have the JavaScript parse it, and then do client side filtering, you know? It's like the data that I'm working with isn't massive by any means, and we don't have scale at all. So it's not something that I think I have to worry about at all. In fact, it's not something that I'm worrying about at all. And what that also does is allows me to, okay, I have data. Now let me construct the UI around it and spend time like making it usable, spend time making it nice to work with. And then if there are speed problems down the road, it's not... The species stuff will never is never, it's only on a singular case, right? So if you're in a post editor, you're spending time there already. It's not something that needs to happen immediately, and the data doesn't have to be there immediately. So again, it's just really not going to cause any problems.
So we still haven't launched Nest Notes, Sean.
Yes. we talked about that last week, I think, right?
And I was pretty sure I was going to have it launched by this episode, but it's not. We're waiting on our photo partner to get us some final numbers and stuff, but it's so close. I can taste it.
Right.
Like, it's right there.
It's not anything that you're doing that's causing you to not launch. It's you're waiting on a third party.
Unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, it's possible that it'll be out by the time this episode goes live on Tuesday. We're recording this on a Sunday. But we'll see. I'm really excited. I'm nervous, but I'm mostly excited.
I haven't done this yet. I have access to your codes, and I haven't gone through and looked how you're handling building. So maybe some people aren't familiar, but you're taking lots of different data points, and you are taking those data points and you're pushing them into basically a custom illustration based off of the data that gets printed.
Well, we're not actually doing custom illustration stuff yet. Right now, what does exist is what we're calling guided moments. And so based on the age of someone in the system, so the app as a whole, for anybody who doesn't know, it's called Nest Notes, and it's focused on basically helping families retain their important memories and share them in a very controllable kind of manner. So you would put your kids' photos up there, but you have really good control over who's able to see that and what various people can see and when, kind of stuff. But anyhow, based on the age of the child, so for example, we know that around between this month and this month is when, you know, the 90 percentile of kids start crawling or whatever. And based on that information, we know the age of everybody in the system, and we generate suggestions on like, oh, has your kid started crawling? If so, you know, add a picture here, and we show like a little illustration of a crawling animal. And that sort of thing. So, and we're building up like a history and prompting people, because it's hard. Sometimes you don't necessarily know. Obviously, with stuff like crawling or walking, most parents would want to write that down. But there's other stuff that helping people track like tooth loss and that sort of thing, that you just might not really think about otherwise. And this will help people easily build out a record, and then they can actually take those things, all that data that they enter over time, and use it to create print products. So that's something. Right now we have photo prints that we're launching with, which are super nice quality. I'm really excited about them. Actually, I'm not personally somebody who is usually super into print stuff, but man, these photos look really good. So I'm excited about that. But yeah, we're basically going to be taking all that data that people enter into the system over time, and then they'll be able to do like a poster that summarizes their kid's first year. And it has all the information that they've entered that is personalized to that kid, and now they have this poster, this kind of keepsake that's a physical representation of it, and also the secure digital backup and storage and viewing system.
Yeah, it's all... I've looked at it very briefly, and it seemed just super complicated. The amount of different data points that you need to collect and keep track of over time seems wild. And if I remember right, you're using JSON schema a lot to kind of facilitate.
Yeah, I heavily use JSON schema throughout the app. So the questions are actually built out in a spreadsheet, which we store in Airtable, actually. For anybody who doesn't know, Airtable is it's a spreadsheet, but it gives you kind of nicer control over how things are formatted. So you can like have a column and then predefine what values are acceptable for that column. And it'll like auto-complete them for you. And you can assign colors to things and link records between tables really easily. It's very, very, very cool. And it's been super useful. But we have basically a huge Airtable spreadsheet that I export to CSV. Mm-hmm. And then my seed task goes through and generates actual database records based on all the information in that spreadsheet. And that defines the spreadsheet defines all the questions, which then get converted into a JSON schema structure that is stored in the database and used to validate. It both generates the form for a person to be able to answer the question, as well as validating the responses based on what data types the spreadsheet specifies. So yeah, JSON schema has been massively, massively helpful. I don't know how I would have done all this without JSON schema.
Yeah, it sounds pretty amazing. I just learned about something I thought was really cool with Ecto, and Ecto is obviously I've mentioned it before, but it's not really like an ORM, but it's kind of like an ORM for Elixir. And I just was trying to figure out, okay, well, how do I work with my JSON and my JSON B columns? How do I handle that? Because I'm going through and migrating things, and I'm using JSON B quite a bit in my Rails app. And I learned that it has something called embedded schemas. And so you can, in your schema definition, you can embed one or embed many, depending on if it's an object or an array being stored in the column. And it kind of works similar to JSON schema, where you can use your validations. You can, if I remember right, you can cast types and all that stuff off of JSON you're just storing into the database, which I thought was really, really cool.
That's incredible. This is a Postgres level feature?
Well, any sort of database that would support like an embedded structure like that, in this case, JSON or JSON B columns. So I know Postgres does it. I don't know about any other database. I don't know any other databases that do that off the top of my head. But it mentions in the documentation that it's okay. Not strictly Postgres, but anything that supports that JSON feature.
Interesting. That's really, really cool.
Yeah, but it reminded me of that because I was trying to figure out, like, obviously, if you're using JSON heavily, and there's lots of business things that rely on that structure being correct, it needs to be validated somehow. It needs to be linted somehow. And
yes.
Yeah, most certainly. And I haven't had a chance to play with JSON schema yet. I kind of want to. You know what? Maybe I should do that with WatchNature's front end, because in the post kind of form, I'm building up a bunch of nested objects in Vuex. And then so when you're creating a post, an observation, and an observation image, and they're all tied together via foreign keys. And so the API only has a post endpoint. So when you send a nested structure to the post endpoint, it creates all three of those at the same time. And obviously the server side will be validating all that stuff and making sure everything's right. But right now I have a couple of different functions scattered about that, you know, in each form component, it's kind of in charge of validating itself, I suppose. But I could probably come up with some sort of way to use JSON schema to just validate that payload by itself.
Yeah, I would imagine so. It is super intimidating though. That's kind of the biggest problem with JSON schema, is that it looks really difficult and complicated. There is a great resource though. It's just called Understanding JSON Schema, and we'll get a link to this in show notes, of course, but I highly recommend it, because the actual like official docs on jsonschema.org are, at least to me, really confusing, and I kind of just didn't know how to work with it. But the Understanding JSON Schema document is super good, and it really breaks it down in a much more understandable way, at least for me. And it's also a great reference for what you can and can't do and how you might achieve certain things in JSON Schema.
Yeah, I looked at the website a while back, and it was pretty intense looking. So I think that's probably why I didn't dive in right away, because I was like, I got other stuff to do. But I'll definitely put that link in the show notes, because it sounds really cool. I mean, you're pretty close to launching. I'm going to ask this next question and assume like, or use the frame of mind like you've already launched. What was, thinking back of all like the many months of hard work for this, what do you think was the most complicated problem to solve in building this app?
It was certainly the front end architecture. Vue and Nuxt have made that... they've given me the ability to make something that is way cooler than I would have been able to do otherwise. Like, bottom line, it feels like they've given me superpowers. But that said, it's still by far the most complex and hardest bit. Like the back end parts are not that much. There is a fair bit to it. Like it's talking to a lot of APIs and it's doing a lot of stuff, but it's all pretty straightforward. Whereas, man, front end is hard.
It is.
There's a lot to it. There's a lot to keeping state and auth in line and handling page transitions and pulling data from APIs and pushing data to API. There's just a lot going on in the front end now.
Isn't that funny to say? Because to me, back end was so intimidating for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Now that I'm more familiar with it, I've built some things with it, I'm feeling pretty comfortable. I'm on my second back end language now, which I think that was a huge milestone moving from one language to the next. Because, you know, for a long time, I felt like, oh, I only know back end because I know Ruby. That's the only reason why I know this. But that's not the case.
Sure.
Moving to Elixir like made me realize, okay, well, I know a lot of concepts because I learned them in the concepts through Ruby, and now I'm applying them elsewhere. But it was so intimidating to me for a long time. And now when I think about front end, I'm like, my God, this is so much harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Front end is super complex. There's just so much. You need an incredible breadth and depth of knowledge to do front end well, especially with a single page app. It's a lot of stuff. It's so much stuff. So I would definitely say that. And I don't know what I would do without Vue and Nuxt. That's some incredible technology right there.
I mean, that's the fact that you say you built something that you would not have been able to without those tools, I think says a lot.
Yeah, just in the amount of time, at least, there's no way, not even close.
And you're one person, just like a team of one, you know, which also says a lot. So I don't know. I thought that was really cool. You know, like I think that says a lot about the technology. And, you know, certainly I know people that would say the same thing about React or whatever, or insert X framework. But that to me is the sign of a good tool where you're just like, man, this tool made it easy for me to build something that I wouldn't have been able to in the time frame and the budget possible beforehand. I think that like that's the whole reason why you would use something. So that's pretty cool. I've been wanting to check out Nuxt a little more. So right now with both Watch Nature and Design Collective, the Elixir versions, I'm using Webpack and Vue 2, but they're just kind of rolled into the same structure. The reason I think about specifically Watch Nature rolling it out into a separate project is so that I could use Nuxt and I could host it elsewhere. But I would only do that to use Nuxt for the server-side rendering stuff.
Yeah, Nuxt it was a bit of a haul to get everything ported over because I had originally built out the majority of the app, or not the majority, but a very large portion of the app just in standard Vue.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I need to switch to SSR because there's just no way that I'm going to be able to do
the
metadata and the Open Graph stuff that I need to do efficiently for this number of pages. Because it's effectively like I've basically built a social network in terms of like the way links will be shared and that sort of thing. It is effectively a social network. And pre-rendering for that is just not going to be feasible on any sort of real scale. So SSR was pretty much my only option. And I was able to, I mean, it was a haul of a couple weeks, but I got everything moved over and was running on Nuxt within I think about a week and a half or 2 weeks, which is also a testament to Nuxt and how flexible and easy it is to implement.
Well, Nuxt is just now hitting 1.0, isn't it? Like fairly recently, or it's not, maybe it's not released yet, but it's like pretty close to one.
It's something like that. I know there's some stuff going on with the latest, Vue 2.3. Uh-huh. With a bunch of SSR changes, and they were kind of held up on that for a while. But I don't know what the status of that is right now.
I mean, that says a lot too for a pre 1.0 piece of software.
Oh, yeah.
That's really cool. I remember, so it's cool hearing you talk about it and having you rubber duck some stuff at me along the way and like knowing some of the problems you needed to solve. I understand why the front end architecture would be the hardest bit. But that the data wrangling that you're doing, especially with the JSON schema stuff, is pretty wild. Like, because you would ask me, like, I have to do this. How would you approach it? I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know either. I'm just guessing. We'll see if it works out.
I wouldn't. The answer is I wouldn't approach it. no, that's cool. I'm excited to see how it goes, you know, put it out there. I know the feeling like putting DK out for the first time, like knowing X, Y, and Z need to change. X, Y, and Z need to be added. H is just broken, you know, like hoping no one stumbles across it. But
this thing is just broken. I hope no one stumbles across it. That is so true. Oh, man. But basically for me, I got to get this thing launched. Hopefully we get this info. I can get it launched in the next couple of days. And then the first time someone I don't know gives us money, I will feel probably the biggest sense of relief I've ever felt in my life.
Well, it's weird because then you feel stressed out because you're like, is this fraud? And so that was like my first few thoughts. Just logging into Stripe every day, looking at Radar. Has anything been flagged? Do I need to add more rules?
Have I done something illegal? Oh, God.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing was when someone called my personal phone one time, I was like, hello? And they're like, is this Design Collective? And I was like, well, I'm a person.
Is this Design?
I wanted to be like, how did you get my phone number?
I guess so.
I didn't ask them that. But they're just like, I haven't received my thing yet.
I think it comes on the receipts, on the Stripe receipts by default. Whatever you have entered in there.
We send out our own receipts.
Oh, weird. Yeah, I don't know that. That's funny.
But maybe I am the business contact on the Stripe account. I don't know. Probably. But they got my phone number, and the only reason I answered it because No Robo didn't block the number as a spam caller. Otherwise, I never answer phone calls on my phone. Yeah, and so they're like, I haven't received my thing. And I was like, well, let me talk to the store owner. And I was like, hey, you need to send this. And they're like, all right, well, we're going to do it. And that was it. That was probably like the most stressful interaction I've had. Oh, first they were like, what is Design Collective? And I was like,
making
what do you mean?
Money on the internet
is weird.
Purchase
something from Design Collective. They got the name because they are reading it off of their statement in their bank and like their online bank account. So I was confused. It's like, what do you mean? What is it? You purchase? Like, I didn't say that, but
oh man,
I was so confused for a little while.
Right.
Anyhow, yeah, no, it's gonna be really cool when that happens.
Thanks again to Rollbar for their continued support of Does Not Compute. Every developer has to deal with production errors at some point, and Rollbar makes it painless. Easy integration with all the other services you love and detailed error reports mean you'll be able to fix production bugs quicker than ever before. Sign up today at rollbar.com/DNC, and you'll get a free month of their Bootstrap plan. Still the bird. This chatty little bird.
Can you hear it?
Yeah.
They're freaking outside. There's like 100 doves outside. I'm sorry, Sarah.